This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders has said that violence in America is an epidemic. It's one of the leading causes of death and injury for our young people. The Centers for Disease Control is now treating violence as a public health problem. My guest, Deborah Prothro-Stiff, is considered the first person to insist that violence is a public health issue. She's an assistant dean at the Harvard School of Public Health and was one of the first women to serve as commissioner of public health for the state of Massachusetts. She also developed the first violence prevention curriculum for schools. She started thinking of violence as a public health issue 15 years ago when she was a resident at Boston City Hospital working in the emergency room.
Well, one night, about 3 a.m, actually, a young man, after I had stitched him up, told me not to go to bed because he was going to go out and cut up the guy who had cut him, send the guy into the emergency room, and I was going to have to do some more stitching. What really struck me with that comment, and he almost said it as a joke, and we all kind of chuckled as he left, but immediately I was struck with how little responsibility my profession had taken for the problem of violence, in particular the prevention. For instance, if he had made a suicide attempt by ingesting pills and I had cleaned out his stomach and then he said, even as a joke, don't go to bed because I'm going to go home and I'm going to take some more pills, I would have had to respond very differently. That would have been an obligation of mine. And I was just struck immediately as to how we treated this problem of violence against others very differently. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that we have a responsibility to do more than stitch people up and send them out or treat them and street them, as some emergency departments are fond of saying.
Well, what can doctors possibly do to help prevent violence?
Well, one of the things that that I started doing was just studying the problem, and that taught me a considerable amount about the problem, which surprised me, actually. For instance, I was surprised to learn that half of the homicides occurred among friends and family who get into an argument. So I realized that our problem is a problem of handling anger and getting along, not just a stranger bad guy violence. I realized that we had a homicide rate that was so much higher than other countries, 10, 15, 20, even 70 times higher than other countries. And I realized that this was a preventable problem, that we didn't have to have this problem. So I thought that physicians and public health practitioners could help prevent violence, just as we had dealt with issues of smoking prevention, drunk driving prevention. We have been involved in attitudes and behavior changes to prevent illness. And it seems to me, and that's what got me started, that those same strategies that we had used around attitudes and behaviors could be helpful around this issue of violence prevention.
Do you still work in the emergency room?
No, I don't. I have one clinic an evening in one of the health centers in Boston, which is a teen clinic where I am one of the primary care physicians there.
Let's look at the emergency room, which is where you first started to get the idea of violence as a public health issue. What can doctors in an emergency room do to prevent violence?
Well, I use the depression and suicide response and prevention model to offer suggestions. At this point, people are developing protocols for emergency departments, which are in some ways modeled after what we do when someone is depressed or has made a suicide attempt. It involves assessing the urgency, in the case of violence, of their intent on revenge. It involves assessing their risk for subsequent episodes of violence. It often involves a referral to a psychiatric nurse or other emergency department mental health professional who can talk through some of those issues and assess whether that person even needs to be hospitalized. The pink slip, which is used to confine involuntarily those patients at risk for suicide, actually says in the, says on the sheet, this person is a threat to himself or others. So it's a part, actually, of what's available, but just not used. It seems that from the emergency department, when children, particularly teenagers, are stitched up, we can offer, especially when they come to get their stitches taken out, some violence prevention counseling and education. And there's one program at Boston City Hospital where those patients are being identified, and a team is responding to their needs. The team includes a social worker, a psychologist, a violence prevention counselor, the nurse, and the physician. And this is applied mainly when children are admitted or teenagers are admitted because of violence, but also could be a part of the emergency room and follow-up experience.
Well, the idea of a physician at a hospital keeping a patient hospitalized because they think that they might be a danger to others, wouldn't that raise civil liberties issues? Couldn't somebody say, I'm being held against my will and you're violating my civil liberties by doing that? I mean, how does any doctor know that I'm going to go out and seek revenge?
Well, the pink slip is a legal document that allows us to hold people against their will if they are a threat to themselves or a threat to others. It is difficult to assess the threat to others, and I think the intent of doing that kind of assessment would not be to hold the person against their will. A lot of the people who are involved in violence, particularly because it is friend and family and acquaintance violence, are afraid. And though they have plans for revenge, they are often very open to discussions of alternative responses. Often, especially teenagers, feel caught up into an escalating set of violent activities that they would like to have stopped. They just don't believe it could be stopped. So the intent of the assessment is not so much to hold people against their will, though with suicide, if you tell a physician that you are going to kill yourself before your next birthday and that you have pills at home in the bottom drawer that you're going to take at 10 o'clock tomorrow night, you probably won't get to leave the hospital.
Have you, as a physician, tried talking with a patient who is a victim of violence about their response and what they plan to do?
Yes. Often in the primary care clinic setting, which is where I see patients now, we come across patients who are participants in violence. Many have been suspended from school for violence. Some are involved in an actively escalating set of circumstances. We've been very fortunate through a grant to hire a violence prevention counselor. While we're working on protocols for physicians that need to be evaluated, and again, we are creating models of intervening that are new, so they have to be evaluated. But while we're doing that, we have a violence prevention counselor who sits down after I've done some conversation, had some conversation with the patient, and really extensively goes through the questions regarding the risk. Because this society, and I hope we'll get into some of the cultural issues as well, but because this society is not very believing of alternatives to violence. It's usually a pretty difficult conversation with patients. It's one worth having. It's one where we've had some successes. But it's not an easy conversation because we're asking that teenager to think differently than his parents, than his community, than his country, than the elected officials in the country, really than the culture really thinks about this issue.
That's really the problem in a way, because for any kind of dispute to be resolved non-violently, it kind of takes both parties to decide to not be violent. Like if somebody's out to get me and I decide I'm not going to be violent about it, well, I might just be leaving myself vulnerable.
Well, and that is a possibility. What we found, however, is that because it takes two to tango, the behavior of one can directly impact the behavior of the other. One of the things we say to kids around the issue of staying safe is, you know, don't spread rumors, don't instigate fights, don't run to see the fight. If somebody says there's a fight over here, go the other way. Now, none of those are things that are necessarily easy for kids to stop doing or to do. But once you start talking about it and they think about it, you raise some possibilities. There are ways to respond to bullies, which may not always be successful, but often are much more successful than fighting the bully. We teach kids to say things like, you know, I don't want to fight you. I don't have a problem with you. Or why are you picking on me? You know, what's wrong that you are bothering me? Or why are you trying to embarrass me? Often, you know, we call it throwing a curve in the curriculum, but often a very different, unexpected response can totally change a situation. And those are the skills that we teach kids in the classroom, but those are the skills that we as adults could have and use better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Prothro-Stith, and she's considered the first person to frame the issue of violence as a public health issue. She's the assistant dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about violence as a public health issue. My guest, Deborah Prothro-Stith, is considered to be the first person to frame the issue of violence in such a way. She's the former state commissioner of public health in Massachusetts and now assistant dean at the Harvard School of Public Health. You know, you've actually designed a curriculum for students to teach them right. Nonviolent alternatives to anger and frustration and threats right. And challenges and so on. What age is it designed for?
Our work has been primarily with older children and young to middle teenage years, really the young teenage years. I would highlight our work with teenagers because often people think, well, that's too late or, mm-hmm. You know, you'll never change their behavior. And we've had some positive experiences.
Tell me one of those experiences.
Well, I'll tell you two. One is a story from a while ago where one of the nurse practitioners here in Boston who was teaching the curriculum had a student come back to see her really depressed. And it's a success story because he had actively avoided a fight. He had been a student in the violence prevention class she was teaching and had actively avoided a fight. He was depressed, however, and this is the not-so-successful part of the story, because his friends and associates had really not thought avoiding the fight was a good idea. So they had really been putting him down. And his parents had not thought it was a good idea either. They thought he should have fought. So while we can have some success with the skills of teenagers, we have to realize that this is a society that encourages and promotes violence. The second story that I'll tell you is a more recent one, and it was one that really surprised me. A young man who spent the summer as a violence prevention educator with the Boston City Hospital Project said about 6 weeks ago that he had been walking down the street and he was confronted by another young man, and confronted in a way that made him feel quite frightened and afraid. He said that he thought about walking away, and that the only reason he thought about it was because he had been involved in that violence prevention stuff. But the only reason he tried it, he said, was because he thought he was going to get killed anyway. So he turned and walked away, and nothing happened. He said, you know, I kept walking and nothing happened. Later, he saw the young man on the basketball court later that afternoon, and he said that they realized that there wasn't much bad between them. In other words, there was no reason for them to fight. Now, I think that's a remarkable story, because walk away is probably one of the most difficult violence prevention concepts to teach. You know, mediation, negotiation, not passing rumors, not escalating a situation. Those are easier concepts. But walk away is so un-American that it is a very, very difficult concept to teach. And this story made me start believing in walking away in a way that I hadn't before, after over 15 years of working on this issue.
But don't you think the truth is a lot of people wouldn't let you walk away? A lot of people would have killed you or would have attacked you?
Well, the truth is we don't know. The truth is there's a lot of mythology about walking away, which is it's impossible to do it, that the person's going to stab you in the back, that if that person doesn't, when they see you later, they're going to get you anyway. And this story debunks a lot of those, in fact, all three of those myths. The truth is we don't know. I think that's a success story that ought to be in the newspaper, because none of us believe in walking away. And now we have a violence prevention peer counselor who not only talks the talk, but has tried it. And he might even get better at it the next time, because he certainly believes it now. I don't know that most people are going to stab you in the back anyway. Our whole perceptions and the mythology around violence is built on this notion that there are some stranger bad guys out there. They're just some bad people, and that we have to protect ourselves against them. Again, when I learned that half of the homicides occur among friends and family and people who know each other, who get into an argument, I realize that, you know, maybe some other strategies will work.
Do you live in a neighborhood now in which there's a lot of violence?
Yes, I do. I live in Roxbury, which is a neighborhood that has the highest homicide rate in Boston, of Boston neighborhoods, and four times higher than the Boston rate. So, yes, we experience violence in our neighborhood.
Now, I know you have a couple of children. How old are they?
My daughter is 12 and my son is 15. I also have a nephew that is 23 that's lived with us for about 12 years. He's now in Atlanta, so he's not with us now.
Now, have you worked with them on the kind of issues that you're teaching in the, you know, in the schools?
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the things that is clear to me is that as families, we've got to learn how to handle our anger. And, you know, it's a surprise that so much of the violence is family and friend violence. Yet, on the other hand, it's not a surprise, because those are the people you see regularly. Those are the people who make you angry. So, and even the role play I've used with my kids, and that's one of the things we do in the classroom, just to help them develop the skills of relating to each other and of getting along. I also talk very openly with them about the issue of violence, how people who make movies and who sell guns make a lot of money off of this destruction, and that they need to understand that that violence isn't funny, it's not entertaining, it's not successful, that it rarely solves problems, that even when you win, you're always worried about revenge, that superheroes don't enjoy it, that all of that's lies, that they're all telling lies, and they're making a lot of money off of it, but it's all lies.
I know that your husband is a pastor, and
yes.
I'm wondering if he has a different approach to dealing with the issue of violence when he's talking to the church as, compared to your approach as a physician.
Well, we do approach it differently. His work as a minister also includes work on economic justice, which is for him a major component of the issue of violence. We know that homicide rates are higher in poor communities. We know that classism and racism are part of the problem of violence in America. And his work focuses on economic justice, economic development, economic empowerment, and those are important aspects of violence prevention. So we do approach it differently.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Deborah Prothro-Stith is an assistant dean at Harvard University School of Public Health. She's also the author of a 1991 book about teenage violence called Deadly Consequences, and she wrote the chapter on preventing violence in the textbook Health Skills for Wellness. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.